Mandatory opening narration. Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome, thoughtful readers. Today, we're diving deep into a novel that's, well, famously challenging but incredibly rewarding. It's Malcolm Lowry's 1947 modernist masterpiece, Under the Volcano.
It really is a monumental work, isn't it? And you can feel Lowry's own life just baked into it. He wrestled with this book for, what, nearly a decade?
Yeah, a decade of obsessive revision. And Lowry himself, I mean, an enigmatic figure, deeply intelligent, but haunted by alcoholism, by despair. That personal struggle is really the heart of the book.
Absolutely. He poured all that anguish into it, transforming it. And the setting he chose is so potent.
Right. This fictional town in Mexico, Cuanahuac. And the whole story unfolds over just one single day.
November 2nd, 1938, the Day of the Dead.
Which
is perfect, symbolically. The past, death, memory, all swirling around.
And all under the shadow of those two massive volcanoes, Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl. So our mission today really is to unpack how Lowry uses this incredibly compressed time frame, just 12 chapters, like 12 hours, or maybe the Stations of the Cross.
That's a common reading, yeah.
How he uses that structure to explore this downward spiral. It feels less like an accident and more like a chosen path to damnation for the main character.
And you have to remember the backdrop, 1938. The world itself is teetering on the edge, right? Fascism rising in Europe, the Spanish Civil War's shadow.
That's a great point. So the personal chaos mirrors this larger global chaos.
Exactly. It adds another layer to the consul's disintegration.
Okay, so let's get into that central crisis. We've got a marriage falling apart, a man's soul collapsing, and the world gearing up for war. All at once. And at the center. Jeffrey Furman, the consul.
Jeffrey. He's such a compelling, tragic figure. Brilliant mind, you know, former Cambridge man, but just crippled by this urge for self-destruction.
And the alcoholism. You mentioned it's not just presented as like a simple addiction.
No, it's much deeper. It feels like a symptom of a profound spiritual sickness, a kind of paralysis of his will, almost. He's incredibly self-aware one moment.
He knows what he's doing.
He absolutely knows. And then the next moment, he's lost in these alcohol-fueled delusions. He even uses his intellect to rationalize it, doesn't he? Twists it into some kind of dark philosophical quest.
Right, searching for deeper meaning at the bottom of a bottle. And then Yvonne arrives, his estranged wife.
Yvonne Furman, she's this flicker of hope, isn't she? She comes back after a year apart, wanting to reconcile, trying to pull him back from the brink.
But it's so fragile, that hope.
Heartbreakingly so. Because she represents love, connection, but she's up against this immense, almost immovable force within Jeffrey. It shows the limits of love, I think, when someone is truly determined to self-destruct. The chasm is just too wide.
And then there's Hugh. Jeffrey's half-brother.
Hugh Furman. Yeah, he's the contrast, the idealist, the journalist, wants to do something about the world's problems, unlike Jeffrey's paralysis.
But he's tangled up in it too, isn't he? His past connection with Yvonne adds this immediate layer of tension.
Oh, definitely. Guilt, loyalty, betrayal. It's all there from the start. The three of them are locked in this volatile dynamic. It makes real communication almost impossible right from the get-go.
So with this charge set up, let's trace how Lowry uses that single day, the Day of the Dead, to push them towards the inevitable. It really does feel like a countdown.
It does, and Lowry even frames it that way. Chapter 1 actually jumps ahead a year to November 1939.
Right, with Jacques Laruelle, the friend, the filmmaker.
Exactly. Laruelle is looking back, remembering Jeffrey and Yvonne, knowing they're already gone. It sets this elegiac, doomed tone right away. We start knowing the tragic end.
Which makes Yvonne's arrival at the start of the main day, November 2nd, 1938, feel even more poignant. Her hope, her suggestion they leave Mexico. You already feel it's probably too late.
And Lowry reinforces that immediately with the description of the consul's villa. That garden.
All the garden. It's supposed to be a paradise, right? But it's overgrown, neglected, full of snakes.
A ruined Eden. It's a perfect symbol for their marriage, for Jeffrey's inner state. The decay is already set in.
Okay, so things really start to accelerate during that bus journey, the trip to Tomalin, chapters 5 to 7, I think.
That's right. And it's pivotal. They come across this dying Indian man by the roadside, robbed, just left there.
And how they react tells you everything.
It really does. Hugh, the idealist, wants to help, wants to intervene. Yvonne is overcome with pity, and Jeffrey.
He's just paralyzed.
Yeah.
He sees the man almost as a reflection of himself, doesn't he? The world is just discarding.
Yeah, it's chilling. He connects it all back to his own pain. Remember that line? How alike are the groans of love to those of the dying?
Oof. yeah. He's filtering universal suffering through his own self-absorption. He chooses paralysis.
And from there, the descent just speeds up. In Tomalin, at the fiesta, Jeffrey is getting more paranoid, more lost in the drink. And then he gets on that Ferris wheel.
La Machina Infernal. The infernal machine.
I mean the symbolism, spinning him out over the Barranca, that huge ravine.
It's like the ground literally opening up beneath him. The point of no return, really.
Absolutely. He's given himself over to it. And then soon after, he pushes Yvonne and Hugh away, tells them, get on the bus, leave him.
And Yvonne? She gets off the bus later, in the storm, trying to find him, still trying to save him, even then, utterly futile.
It leads straight into that horrifying climax in Chapter 12. Jeffrey ends up in the Farolito.
That cantina. He even calls it the bottom of the world.
And that's where his personal hell collides with the political reality of 1938 Mexico, the fascist-linked police, the sinarquistas.
They mistake him for a spy.
Right. And in his drunken state, he essentially provokes them, baits them. It's like his death wish finds its instrument in the world's own violence.
And his death is so brutal, so dehumanizing, shot, then just tossed into the Barranca.
Followed by a dead dog. Discarded. And at almost the exact same moment, Yvonne, lost in the woods during the storm, is trampled by that runaway horse.
It's this awful, crushing synchronicity. Cosmic finality.
And the authorities just file it away, confiscate his things, erase. Like the political violence just swallows them whole.
So after all that, this devastating story, what's the larger meaning Lowry is driving at? The way he handles addiction seems key.
It really is. He elevates it beyond just a personal failing. It becomes the symbol of, well, of a spiritual choice, a kind of willed damnation.
That idea that Jeffrey almost chooses this path, even rationalizes it.
Yeah, remember he talks about drinking to achieve a deeper level of perception, that quote about understanding the old woman playing the guitar.
How, unless you drink as I do.
Right.
But is that presented as true insight, or is it the ultimate self-deception?
I think the novel shows the terrible cost of that thinking. He gains maybe moments of this perceived insight, but he loses love, communication, life itself. The price is absolute.
Which brings us to that theme of isolation, the impossibility of communication. They love each other, or seem to, but they just can't reach each other.
They're trapped in their own subjective worlds, and the irony hangs on that Spanish phrase that echoes through the book.
No se puede vivir sin amar.
One cannot live without loving. Jeffrey knows this. Intellectually, he gets it. But he still chooses the path away from love, towards oblivion.
The symbolism really helps anchor this. Those volcanoes you mentioned earlier.
Popocatépetl and Ixtaccíhuatl. Yeah, they're like these silent, eternal witnesses, representing perhaps cosmic indifference or maybe the vast destructive forces just inherent in existence looming over the tiny human drama.
And the Barranca, the ravine. It's the literal pit he's thrown into, but it's also the spiritual abyss he's been heading towards all along.
Definitely. But the symbol that really hammers home his agency, his choice in the matter, is that sign in his ruined garden.
Yes. Le gusta este jardín que es suyo. Evite que sus hijos lo destruyan.
Do you like this garden that is yours? See that your children do not destroy it. It's such a direct challenge. The garden is his soul, his marriage, his potential.
And the children are his destructive impulses, his addiction.
Exactly. He sees the warning, he understands it, and he still lets the garden fall to ruin. He chooses inaction.
And Lowry delivers all this through that incredibly dense stream of consciousness style. It pulls you right inside Jeffrey's head.
Right into the warped lens of an alcoholic intellectual, as you said earlier. Memory, delusion, reality, literary illusions, Dante, Faust, the Kabbalah, it all just swirls together.
It makes it challenging, but that's also what makes it so powerful. You experience his fragmentation, his isolation. The language itself becomes part of the theme.
Yeah, it's a masterful performance. And it leaves you contemplating some really tough questions about human responsibility.
Yes.
Does being brilliant, being deeply self-aware like Jeffrey, actually make it harder sometimes? Can it trap you in an analysis and self-pity instead of leading you out?
It's an unsettling thought. Ultimately, Under the Volcano feels like this stark reminder that maybe hell isn't somewhere else. Maybe it's a state we can actively choose, cultivate within ourselves through self-destruction.
A terrifying but profoundly resonant idea. It stays with you long after you finish the book.
It certainly does.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.